Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of NationalReview.com. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And Jim, as we enter into this shorter work week after the nation paused to honor those who have served and given their lives in service to the country, back to work right away for Congress, which is kind of rare. Usually there's about a 2 to 3 week recess for any national holiday, but not the case. In fact, the House of Representatives later today will vote on President Obama's version of dealing with the debt ceiling, which is to raise it without taking any sort of fiscal restraint measures whatsoever. And it's obviously going to fail in the House, which it should. And it's going to fail overwhelmingly. It probably won't be unanimous like his budget failed in the Senate last week. But if you take these two together, it's pretty clear that the president has been roundly rebuked. It's kind of interesting that his version of addressing the fiscal crisis has not been covered to the extent that this certainly would have if a Republican president suggested doing nothing essentially on these issues. But the president getting slammed in the Senate, and it's about to get slammed in the House, and now we can get on to real solutions.
You know, Greg, I think you're being a little harsh on the president. I am certain that on at least 17 of the 18 holes yesterday, he was worried about this. He was thinking about it a great deal. That's why his putting game was off. His short game was not what it usually is. So it'll be very interesting to see this vote. I'm sure that the National Republican Congressional Committee will also be very curious about this vote, watching any remaining red state or red district Democrats who votes to raise the debt limit without any, you know, serious fiscal or financial reform efforts whatsoever. Coming soon to an attack ad near you, I think we can see the results of this. It should be, another tough vote for the president. And it's kind of fascinating. Resurgent Republic has some really eye-opening poll numbers on this. You know, Republicans are completely behind this. They believe, you know, if you're going to raise the debt ceiling, you sure as heck better do some sort of serious spending cuts to go with it. Independents are by and large with it, not as well as much as Republicans, but that's kind of to be expected. Unsurprisingly, Democrats are, you know, supportive of raising the debt ceiling with no real serious spending reforms.
Yeah, shocking.
However, even they are a little iffy on this, that it's not the traditional, you know, 90-10 number you might think to see there. So this is a winning issue for Republicans. They've got public opinion on their side. They don't always act like it. They don't always sound like it. But it's one of those things where I don't think that, you know, the traditional, you know, argument of, oh, they're hostage takers and they're running the risk of destroying the national credit rating and our fiscal future. No. Runaway spending is, you know, putting the fiscal future at risk. And all that the Democrats have to do is say, all right, here's our plan for spending reduction in this year, next year, et cetera. Just put something serious on the table. And I think a lot of Republicans would be more than happy to get this issue done and then start focusing on the budget for the coming year. And, you know, I think it's probably indicative of Obama at the middle of this, you know, what arguably could be considered a national debt crisis. He's going around giving speeches talking about reducing Egypt's debt.
Yes, and the money we're going to continue to spend to help them in their in their new existence. And it's interesting that on the one hand, we see these polls where people are leery about the Ryan plan, particularly the Medicare aspects of it. But at the same time, the polls, I think, are even more dominant in being opposed to doing nothing. So I think even though there's some skepticism out there about the way that Ryan and some other conservatives are approaching this, I think the momentum, if there is momentum, is on their side because people are definitely anathema to keeping things the way they are. And without any other competing plans in order to address it, that's got to work in his favor over time, if not in the very near term. So we'll see what happens there. Otherwise, in terms of the economy, we've got some excellent news, Jim, coming from...
I was about to say, look, as bad as the spending circumstances look, Greg, at least we've got a thriving economy that can, you know, lift all boats and help us alleviate all the suffering, right?
Yes, yes. U.S. house prices, according to the Case-Shiller Housing Index, falling in March, dipping below their 2009 low. Remember that? The bottoming out of the whole mortgage crisis? Yeah, it's worse than that now. So good thing the stimulus plan was in there. Good thing that first-time homebuyers tax credit really hung in there and stimulated the market all the way through. Prices in 19 of the 20 cities covered were lower than a year ago, with 12 cities seeing new index lows. So I don't know if last summer certainly wasn't the recovery summer. This one certainly isn't shaping up to be one either.
Greg, you see this news. I see this news. What really is important is I hope the property tax commission see this news because there are a whole lot of localities going to say, real estate tanking? I didn't see anything like that. No. Your house went up a couple percentage points. That's why your property taxes are going up higher, as is the case here in Alexandria. I'm looking at this headline, real estate market tanks again. For a lot of us, but never mind the real estate market, I say the general economy, the concept of a double dip assumes at some point we had good times in the middle. And I think most of us would argue that there really hasn't. We've seen, obviously, we stopped losing 700,000 jobs per month. Obviously, we hit bottom. And we did see several months of, I'd say, very modest job creation, but certainly nothing that would feel like a genuine economic recovery. And this, you know, bad news with housing comes on top of high fuel prices, comes on top of inflation we've seen. And obviously, when, you know, fuel prices go up higher, the cost of everything that gets moved, which is basically everything on the shelves, gets more expensive. It'll be really interesting to see if Obama attempts to call this a double dip, because he's actually been fairly good, other than the, you know, all the fireworks and bonanza they had over the recovery summer that wasn't last year. Obama, whenever he announces job gains, is usually saying, well, you know, but we know this isn't enough. Well, I think most Americans would say this is nowhere near enough. And the idea that we could end it towards another slump, look, I think for all extents and purposes, if it really is another genuine deep recession, his presidency is over. And now, you know, there are probably a lot of nervous, sweaty brows over at the White House. And it's not just the 90-some degree heat we have here in Washington.
Exactly right. And you know, it was just a few weeks ago where you and I were talking about how the Standard & Poor's revised the outlook for the U.S. economy to negative. Well, Standard & Poor's also does this housing index. And here's the really uplifting quote from the guy who's the chairman of the index committee at Standard & Poor's. Home prices continue on their downward spiral with no relief in sight. Well, break out the good martini for that one. Good grief.
You know, the name Standard and Poor seems to fit, doesn't it? Since it looks like the new standard is we'll all be poor.
Ah, very nice. Very nicely done. On to number three now. And last week, of course, the president was in Europe. We chronicled that pretty extensively. But while he was there, some debates were still playing out here in Washington, one of which was to extend certain provisions of the Patriot Act, which were set to expire last week if Congress didn't take action. Well, Congress took action. And then a new controversy erupted because the legislation was signed by an auto pen since the president was in Europe. Because apparently, Jim, you can't scan an email to the president or fax it to the president or use some sort of technology that I'm pretty sure the White House has access to get his actual signature on it. And so you have a congressman wondering if that's actually legitimate. Doesn't the president actually have to sign it? That's what it says in the Constitution. And there's only been two auto pen stories. I'm not anti-auto pen, but the only two we've ever actually seen in the headlines is when the Pentagon, during Donald Rumsfeld's administration there, had auto pen signing condolence letters to the families of fallen troops. Definitely not good. Now we've got an auto pen signing federal legislation. So I'm not opposed to wiping it out entirely, but on major things like those, I think it's probably time to hit the retirement.
You yearn for the personal touch, yes.
Yes.
I have a couple of thoughts on this, Greg. My first worry, look, I fully support the Patriot Act as is. My biggest, most disturbing about it was that the auto pen signed President Skynet, which, you know, that's just not supposed, that's not in the programming. I don't know if it's a virus or what it is. The second thought is, I would look at this, you know, my attitude is always in these sorts of things, go back to the original intent. Clearly, you talk to the founding fathers, clearly the signature indicates the president agrees with the legislation. So there's nothing in the Constitution that says his fingers must hold a quill and write
right.
it. You know, I mean, to me, the faxing it, emailing it, all this sort of I don't quite subscribe to the notion that he must sign the particular piece of legislation that passed through Capitol Hill. And finally, the third thing is, whenever the president goes on one of these long trips and somebody like you or me starts making snarky comments about the president being away from Washington for long stretches and say, you know, launching a war in Libya while he's in Brazil or something like that, we're always, you know, told, oh, you're being ridiculous. The president has Air Force One. It's the most high-tech communications array in the world. The White House travels with him. He can do anything in Air Force One that he could do in the White House. And now we see, no, apparently he can't. Apparently, you know, he can't sign legislation. So thankfully, most legislation is not such a critical deadline that it has to be signed that very second. But it just seems bizarre to have suddenly found this hang-up after being told for years and years and years, the White House is just a building. He doesn't need to be there. He can be anywhere he wants, and the job goes with him. So it's a little bit odd. I'm not terribly worried about it. I do kind of think that at some point, if we could get the teleprompter hooked up to a voice modulator and the auto pen just to sign it, after a while, we won't need President Obama at all. It'll just be entirely automated presidency, and he can finally get all that time on the golf course he's been yearning for.
Exactly. Whatever happened to those rubber stamps with people's signatures on it? You can just dip it on the ink pad and stamp it on there. I think that would probably even go over a little better than what we saw. But yes, you'd think something this low-tech would be able to not be a problem. Anyway, Jim, great to be back with you. We'll talk to you again tomorrow. Jim Garrity of NationalReview.com. I'm Greg Karembas of Radio America. Please join us tomorrow for the next edition of the Three Martini Lunch.